disappear into the wood.
And they disappear.
Yeah, that I did, darkness in there, and I thought I had enough, and I ran out of the door. I'm hoping that you should carry this.
So I guess I, welcome everybody to the 4 o'clock discussion of Gods and Men. His first question I should ask though, is there anyone in the room who did not get to see the movie either last night or at some other time? Because that might influence. Now, I don't know what other people, I mean, we could show some excerpts from it, or we could just launch into the discussion. I don't know if there's any scenes we want to see. I don't know, do you feel
the
launch?
Since I'm in the minority, I don't want to launch.
Just to go ahead and start launch? Okay. So that, you know. All right. Well, first, just to say a few words, but I think mostly I just want to open it up and to hear what people think and to share ideas about what does this movie mean and you know, what messages can we learn from it. But the reason I showed the film is, well, first to introduce myself, I'm Stephen Voltz. I teach history at Kenyon College in Ohio. Teach primarily African history, also some international studies. And here at Holden, I'm actually here for 2 weeks on the teaching staff. This is my second week. And during the second week, the sort of theme of my four sessions is religious pluralism in the Maghreb. Maghreb meaning Western North Africa, or Maghreb just means the West in Arabic, referring to the Western edge of the Muslim world for much of history. So religious pluralism, the basic theme or question that I'm trying to address in my four sessions this week is, given that the Maghreb is sort of, well, given the existence of the three major monotheistic religions, historically all sort of interacting with one another, for the most part peacefully, you know, what does this indicate for the potential, what potential is there for these three religions to get along with each other? In what cases have they gotten along with each other or not gotten along with each other? What helps to explain sort of the areas of overlap and areas of cooperation and harmony, and what explains these episodes, such as depicted in the last movie, when you do have conflict and violence. And one reason I like the movie for this theme for the week is that it shows you both things. It shows you, on the one hand, people trying to get along with each other, or who are genuinely getting along with each other, Muslims and Christians, but at the same time, you have violence. And so that's one of the questions raised, that I would raise and discuss in the film is, what was the source of that violence? Were they killed because they were Christian? Or were they killed because they were French? Or were they killed because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time? So those are kind of the questions. And then sort of the build-up to this film, on Tuesday I did a session on Judaism, looking at, in sort of basic terms, the history of Judaism in the Maghreb and how Judaism has played an integral role in the society of Morocco in particular, but also Algeria and Tunisia. Then yesterday I did a session on Christianity, looking at Christianity and how it was very much established in Tunisia in particular, and to a certain extent in Algeria and Morocco from ancient times. But then its situation changes with the Arab conquest, and then again it changes with French colonization. And now I illustrated how it's changing again in the last 20 years as sub-Saharan Africans, who are predominantly Christian, are moving to those same countries. And so then today's session is to look at seeking peace in a time of war, looking at the case of the 1990s in Algeria, as illustrated, as dramatized in this film. And then tomorrow the session is, I call, the unity of God, to kind of wrap it all up, looking at the case of Islamic Sufism or mystical Islam, which has had a very heavy influence in the Maghreb in particular, in Western North Africa, in Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria. Sort of the dominant form of Islam in many respects is Sufism. And so I'm going to look at, okay, what does that mean when you have sort of Muslim mystics sort of determining how Islam is exists in those societies? How do they incorporate Christianity, Judaism, and Berber religions into Islam and sort of make a very distinctive Islam for that part of the world? So that's tomorrow's session. But just a preview here, just to get everyone up to the historical context again for what this film depicts. It depicts an actual event that happened in between. Actually, the film encompasses about 3 years of time, from about 1993 to 1996, during which time this French monastery, French Catholic monastery, up in the mountains of Algeria, Right, became this focus of attention, not just for, you know, potential for a rebel attack, but also the government as a sort of a vulnerable outpost, as something that might embarrass them, as you know, if the French government, I mean, if the rebels are going.
So not to be really stupid about it, but Algeria was a French colony a long time ago?
Yeah, from about 1850 to about the late 1950s, 1962
okay,
is when
that
Algeria.
Long. Okay, yeah. So clearly the governmental person blames the French for all of this.
Well, for not giving Algeria sort of an adequate opportunity to build its own country, if you will. The French colonized it during the 19th century, and it was heavily colonized. At one point, there was more than a million French people living in Algeria, and sort of making it their own. And then when the Algerians or the indigenous people sought independence, the French said no. And there was a bloody war during the late 1950s. You could call it, in some respects, sort of the French Vietnam. I mean, you know, they refused to give it up and were willing to fight to the death to keep it, and as were the Algerians. So that left, obviously, a bad taste.
So they still speak French there?
Yeah, in the language of, two official languages, French and Arabic.
But did the French people leave?
Most of them did. But quite a few stayed behind. Enough.
So this is a people that haven't governed themselves.
Well, since 1962, they've governed themselves. Yeah. And so, right, but there is a pretty significant French presence there still, whether it's church folks or shop owners, even French who stayed, who had been living there for two or three generations, didn't want to leave. They saw Algeria as home. I mean, Albert Camus describes this in the book The Stranger. You know, takes place. It's, you know, shows you kind of the French settler mentality, if you will, in Algeria. So they saw it as home, and so quite a few French stayed and became Algerian citizens and worked for the government or work in business and so forth. So that's another layer of complication here that emerges a little bit in the film. But most of the film, right, deals with 1990s, and I guess just to review that. With all this kind of the worldwide surge in democratization that occurred during the late 1980s, you know, fall of the Berlin Wall, Philippines, I don't know, you know, end of apartheid in South Africa, there's this, you know, this kind of all over the world. You had these, you know, with the end of the Cold War, as the Cold War ends, you have this democratization taking place all over. Algeria was no exception. So there, the people began to demand, let's have democratic elections, and so the government, which was sort of a military socialist government, very similar to what you had in Libya or Egypt at the time, or Syria even. I mean, it's a pretty strict military socialist government. Reluctantly agrees that, all right, we'll have democratic elections in 1990-1991. Well, as you'd think the government would have anticipated this, the sort of Islamist party got the most votes. I mean, they weren't sort of fundamentalist at that time. It was more sort of moderate Islamic party, but still sympathetic with the idea of introducing some elements of Islam as sort of the official religion. Well, the secular government was not happy with that, and so they rejected the results of the election. They said, well, we tried democracy, and the wrong people won the election. and so they negated the results of the election and declared martial law, state of emergency. And so suddenly, you know, what had been, you know, Islamic politicians running for office now suddenly were outlaws. And so what quickly, you know, evolved in between 92 and 93 was this war broke out, where the supporters of this Islamic party now suddenly realize that if we can't win influence at the ballot box, then we'll take up arms. And so what happens is, starts out small, but as it becomes increasingly more violent and terroristic, as referred to in the movie, then the government obviously cracks down on this, and as they crack down more and more, then the rebel group gets more sympathy, and so it just tears apart the society. And it goes on until 1999, until finally the rebels and the government come to a peace agreement and the government makes some concessions.
Who armed them?
I think they had their own weapons. I think it was enough weapons washing around. I'm not sure who, you know. I mean, they could have gotten them from just about anywhere, I think. So that's what the movie, the setting of the movie here. So you have this kind of French colonial background. So the French, I mean, there's still this kind of, you know, tainted by the colonial history. So you can see that might explain some of the animosity, some animosity towards French. But yet this monastery has been there for 100 years, so obviously it's become an integral part of the community. And so the question raises, you know, how Algerian can Christianity be? I mean, does this monastery, and does Christianity belong in this village? And that's, I think, one of the questions. But so that's the context. Before we can openly discuss, any other questions about kind of the setting or what's going on? Yeah.
I wondered if you had any thoughts about what a French colonialism was, because in connection with Haiti, mm-hmm. and with some place like Cameroon, there's been people who said that French colonialism was especially difficult, and partly because the French tended to keep themselves very separate from the people who were there, and maybe really, well, in Haiti anyway, you know, really treated them almost as slaves. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, was there that kind of temper to it in Algeria too, where they were really such second class citizens?
I think in Algeria the most important factor was just the sheer number of French settlers, and that they really saw Algeria as their new home and came there with the intention of staying, you know. And so all of the best farmland near the coast was owned by French farmers, you know, so it wasn't just the French in sort of these urban enclaves, which you have in other parts of Africa. Here it was a little more with the intention of expanding French influence much further. So I think that's what made the fight so violent, was the French settlers, you know, there for 2-3 generations didn't want to let it go. Yeah.
Didn't the French, their fight against the Allies in World War II when they invaded, when the Allies invaded?
Oh, briefly. I mean, once the French lost to the Germans, then the Vichy France government took over, and Algeria fell under the control of Vichy France. And so, you know, theoretically, we're allies then of the Nazi government. But they didn't. Shoot, I don't think they fought very long against the Allies. Once they realized that the U.S. was coming in, the British were coming in, I think they were not willing to fight against them too long. I think they scuttled all their ships too in the Algerian naval yards. I mean, rather than let them fall into the hands of the Nazis. In fact, I can't remember how exactly that worked. All right, so maybe just, I mean, I have a bunch of questions and stuff, but maybe we just kind of launch into this. Well, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of actually information about the main character, Christian de Chered. But I think maybe we'd just rather start with, what are your impressions of the movie? Just kind of start off with a blank slate.
I really didn't remember the event, to be honest with you. I guess it certainly was historically significant, but I don't remember hearing about it.
Yeah, I didn't hear about it either. The slaying of the priest.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I guess I had two thoughts. One, the people that they served and themselves are kind of caught in the crossfire, as often happens. People have nothing to do with these. They're just trying to live their lives, and they're caught in the crossfire. They don't really have a point of view, either the people they served in the local community or. But the thing that I thought also intriguing was how they came to their decisions about things, the process of discernment and inclusion, and then Christian had to be reminded that they all had a voice, but then he deferred. So I thought that was that was really interesting to walk with them in that decision making.
Yeah, that was one question. I mean, how much time and care is devoted to sort of understanding the rhythms of life in the monastery? You know, just these very slow, deliberate scenes about them just praying and eating dinner. You know, wordlessly eating dinner, listening to articles being read. I mean, is the movie more about sort of a promotional film for monastic life, or is it about Algeria? Is it more about Algeria or more about a monastery?
Well, other than the doctor and his service, they didn't seem to me to be as proactive as I expected them to be in the community.
That they seemed, at least just picked in the film, they were more kind of just taking care of the monastic farm and
Well, he said he treated 150 people a day. You know, he was getting tired.
That was
yeah.
So he was doing something.
Right. The doctor and the even older man who was his assistant.
But what were the others doing, is what you're saying? What were the others doing on behalf of the community?
Be proactive in the community.
But they were in the market, and they went to the boys' initiate.
Yeah, sort of like a bar mitzvah.
Yeah, so
So they were very welcome.
Mm-hmm. And selling honey, right, I mean, in the market.
Well, they had to support themselves too, so maybe that was their part of it, even though they weren't directly communicating with the people. They had to keep their monastery going. So maybe that's where their energy went.
Well, and it seemed to me they were sharing some, because there was that young woman that was often there that seemed that she was learning some skills by spending time with them, working with them.
I felt it was sort of a demonstration in a way of self-serving themselves. I mean, they were there because of their religious faith and their monastery. That was them. But like you say, they were self-supporting themselves, and then they did their, you know, their praying and all this and that. But they really didn't actively get involved, as we would think, as missionaries going into the community and staying in the community and doing something in that respect.
As a monastic order, right.
So they kind of set themselves up and being isolated and not getting involved.
Right.
I don't think we know from the movie how much involved in the community they were. It's a tiny slice.
Yeah.
I find myself wanting to absolutely dislike the fact that that film was made because I want to dislike the Muslims intensely. And
they weren't Muslims. They were
Muslims.
They were
Jamaat Islamiyah.
Yeah, terrorists basically. They weren't represented at all.
Well, it rubs off. And yet, on the other side of the coin, you know, I want to understand.
So that by them,
what their dilemma was.
By them, you mean the guys with the guns, or the woman who is planting seeds, or?
No, I find myself wanting to resent them because, not because they're not Christians. Mm-hmm. But the way, you know, the terrorists come in, and we are swayed by the way they act, as they are swayed by the way some of our forces act. And I don't know how you ever come to grips with that.
Well, I guess I was to say them. That's what I'm still. Who in the movie is they? Because I guess the way I respond is just talk about Muslims in the movie. You had a huge variety of Muslims in the movie.
Yeah, the from guys Muslims who were they represented were very kindly.
Right.
Yes. So I guess it's the terrorism that comes out of that. And I don't know, I suppose, I don't know if America's probably viewed that way too in other parts of the world.
Well, it was some French drink.
I mean, was it someone who makes religious movies, or?
I don't think so. I think they're just taken by the story and got drawn into it. Yeah.
And if you remember, the government troops didn't treat the people in the village much better. I mean, they didn't shoot anybody, but they were very curt and, you know, giving
that's
words,
what,
basically.
Because that's what, yeah, does being Muslim constitute any sort of shared identity in the film? Do we get the sense that the Muslims hang together somehow, or that Muslims is a...
Well, it's more the power versus people. Because the people in the village seem to get along with each other well. But these outsiders came in and they wanted to throw their weight around, show off their guns. Like the helicopter just flying over all the houses. Innocent people. You know.
Right.
Who was the helicopter?
That was the church.
That was the government.
That was the government forces.
How did you know?
The fact that he had a gun hanging down.
I know, but there were government forces, and then there were the those other people who came in and threatened.
Well, the terrorists didn't have helicopters.
How do you know?
Yeah, well, it's just
I mean, that's what my point is. Okay. It was confusing to me.
Yeah, the rebel group, just operated with small arms and had it ran off and hid in the woods.
Well,
whereas the army was operated by day with armed helicopters and the trucks and uniforms.
So who took them away?
It was the rebel group, the Jamaat Islamiyah.
A couple of things. Somebody mentioned, I mean, people are caught in the crossfire in these wars all the time. I think about the American Revolution. In New Jersey, there were Americans living who, if the British moved through town, they fed them and housed them, and that kind of had to. And then, a few months later, Washington's forces would come through and they'd serve them. I mean, the priests were kind of caught in this kind of thing. But I think the main thing I got away from with this movie was these priests who take vows to serve Christ. One of the bottom lines is, you know, there's no greater love than to lay down your life for your friend.
Mm.
And they were caught, it seems to me, between not wanting to be deliberate martyrs. You know, they said that. The Christian, the guy who was ahead of it, said, you know, we didn't come here for martyrdom. And but they were caught between, you know, not wanting to be martyrs and not wanting to, and you know, and not wanting to chicken out in their commitment to Christ.
Well, at this point, I think I'll share with you a little bit about the main character, Christian Desherges' own background. I think is really illustrative of his motivations. I mean, he's a real person. He, in 1959, when Algerians were fighting for their independence, and the French went in full bore and tried to stop it, Christian Desherges was in the army at that time, the French army. So he was a part of these forces that went in there to fight against the Algerians. Well, so he befriended a Muslim police officer named Mohammed. So they're, technically speaking, the police officer and the French soldier are on the same side, and they're both trying to keep the peace and to, you know, maintain the safety of the towns. But Desherges at the time was pretty religious already, and so he had these long conversations with Mohammed about relations between Christians and Muslims. So he was already, you know, concerned about this question. Well, one time when they were out walking, a band of rebels at that time, and not explicitly Muslim rebels, but just happened to be, you know, the guys who were fighting, the freedom fighters, who were fighting for independence, accosted them, and what happened is Muhammad basically defended Christian Desherges. He put his body in the way and says, no, don't kill my friend here, he's a godly man, you would be doing a sin if you killed this French soldier, even though he seems to be the enemy. If you really know who he is, you know, you shouldn't kill him. And they didn't. The rebels didn't shoot him. And so it kind of took his word for it. Well, the very next day, Mohammed's body showed up. Some other rebels said, how could he be taking the sides? He's a collaborator with the French. So to lay down your life for another, that's what, you know. So Mohammed laid down his life for the life of Christian Desherges. Well, this made a big impression on him. And so when he got out of the army, went back to France, he joined the Trappist monastery, you know, became a monk, and asked to be stationed back in Algeria. So back in Algeria, then he'd been in Algeria for a while. He was at this the Notre Dame monastery up in the Atlas. But he also sort of made a name for himself, you know, caused some controversy among his superiors because he did focus more on ministering to the poor and less on evangelism, as we see in the film. He was more concerned about making friends with the people in the village and ministering to their needs and, you know, sort of being a good neighbor rather than trying to win converts. And so he was clearly had some sympathy and interest with Islam, and that was obviously was illustrated in the film. And maybe later on I can do it now. I mean, at the very end of the film, when they're quoting from Desherges, that's from a real letter that he wrote. At one point in the film, they depict it where he's writing, and then he signs with an Arabic term, inshallah. It puts it in an envelope and kind of spits it there. Well, what that was is he, in 1994, 2 years before they were killed, about a year after the first sort of incident, he wrote a letter to his mom and basically said, instructed her, you know, if I'm killed, open this letter up. And that's what it was. And it's been published since then, and I have the text of the whole letter here I can hand out. But it's really something. I mean, he's, you know, all that he's saying about it. Yeah.
I thought that one scene when he's talking, the first time that the rebels come, mm-hmm. and he quotes the Quran
right.
mm-hmm. To the rebel leader, and the rebel leader pulls back, and you know, I think that was a very powerful scene, that somehow that rebel leader, even though he was a terrorist, also respected this Christian who had knowledge of the Quran.
Right, right. And the other thing that happened in the scene, what else did the Desherges say that sort of demonstrated his respect for Islam? Recall how he identified Jesus? Sidna Isa, which is, you know, is the Arabic word for Saint Jesus, as it were. You know, the holy man Jesus. And so, and then of course the terrorist responds by respectfully identifying him by his French name, Yesu.
Well, he may have protected them a little bit till he was killed by the government and dragged through the town. And then once that happened, then any sympathy that his followers had for the monks maybe disappeared, and they could hope that he, by capturing them, that their own guys who were in prison or something could be exchanged. And then that didn't happen. But I think he was, he and Christian kind of had a respect for each other as leaders.
Right.
But didn't, was there one part where they didn't weren't truthful about what medicine they had?
Oh, when they, yeah. So they could have given away
medicine. We can't, if we give them some medicine, then they will be coming and asking for more medicine. And so then that was a lie, which was problematic.
Yeah, perhaps. Well, or I think he was the doctor was making the point, well, we can give them all the medicine, but then we don't have anything left over for the kids and women.
Yeah.
So he was saying, if we had extra medicine to spare, then maybe.
Why didn't the French exchange hostages and give these priests back?
I think it's, you know, don't negotiate with terrorists, I think was basically it. But, well, let's just encourage them to capture more French, because I'm sure there was, you know, thousands of, you know, French, you know, people of French ancestry living in Algeria.
I thought the depiction of hate was very well done with the rebel leader, that the way he looked at Christian and the other monks.
Mm.
There is hatred.
Oh, that he looked like, I mean, even though he left them alone the first time, he thought that it looked like he was ready to kill them, or... I was wondering about that. I mean, do you think, I mean, given sort of that it was the Jamaa Islamiyah that ultimately kills them, do you think that the movie sort of unfairly seems to portray the government as equally complicit in this violence, or do you think it didn't? I mean, does the government come across as...
Well,
on the side of the monks?
The history of Algeria up to that point was a lot of terrorism, a lot of government violence against the terrorists and innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a culture of violence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know which monk it was commented that it was a corrupt government.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that was crazy.
They were caught.
I think most people would agree, outside observers would agree, there were some legitimate, you know, concerns, grievances of the people against the government, but they were pretty authoritarian. And
well, if they turned back a democratic election.
Right.
Well, clearly, they don't understand it then, right? That's what my point was earlier, is that the French left in the 50s, so did they have an understanding of democracy? They wanted democracy, but hadn't lived democracy.
Mm-hmm.
That means you win some, you lose some.
Yeah, but then clearly that's not, they didn't understand that. I mean, I wonder if that isn't happening still
Egypt.
In the Middle East.
Well, that's
they
part of what's happening with the whole
that.
Arab Spring. I mean, Egypt, as we speak, is trying to decide between, you know, the two candidates they're going to choose from is one who is connected with the former, you know, military government, and the other one is
well, but the point being, whoever wins, is they are they going to let them win? You know, that's one of the things that I remember reading that was very poignant, that the transition of government in a democracy is peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So, and a lot of people who think they want democracy don't get that peace. They may not like it.
Right, don't, you know, the whole, you know, rule by the majority doesn't want to get respected.
Yeah. Or whatever's considered the majority.
What role did the Catholic Church play during the time of the French colonization of Algeria?
I think, they were seen more as collaborators, I would say. Well, particularly the sort of the diocese centers in the Algerian cities. There was sort of a rural-urban thing going on where most of the French were in the cities, and so the Catholic Churches in the cities were primarily there to serve the interests of the French settlers, so they were kind of centers of sort of settler lifestyle and so forth. But I think so. To have this monastery out in the rural area where they're completely surrounded, sort of an island, as it were, surrounded by Algerians, I think that was seen as unusual. I mean, and that was reflected a little bit in the movie too. Even the Algerian, you know, mayor or whatever, fears for their life and wonders, why don't you move, get out of there?
And then the guy that came to bring them things, their supplies, was marched off, which was kind of
he just arrived and
right and hey.
I don't know how they didn't find those other guys that were just hiding under their beds.
Yeah.
That was depicted.
I'm not sure if they actually, you know, who knows how they actually managed.
Yeah, they found the guy under the bed. Who was the other man that was there?
I'm not sure where he hid. He was another monk, but they didn't show us in the film where he hid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I thought he was the one that was a farmer, like stayed around with the in the barn areas in the field.
Oh, is that? That's like provoke some more thought discussion. What this is, I made 20 copies. If I can make more copies, if people would like it.
If you don't need to run me, Steve.
Yeah.
You need to run me.
Oh, sure. I bet you grab one of them. Well, here, or you can grab my. Maybe 10 or 15.
So, while you're waiting for copies, one of the ways this story is very close to home for us. We have a daughter who's in a monastery of two people in northern Honduras, in rural Honduras. Mm-hmm. They're American women here, identifying with the poor. Mm-hmm. It's a very troubled country, as you may know. Yeah. And there was a coup, which you may have heard about, 2 years ago. We don't know who caused that coup. Took out the duly elected president and put in the military. The U.S. was behind it. The U.S. is everywhere in Honduras.
Right.
And so if there were to be military action, our daughter, who's an American, would stick out. We would be, no one would know what side these Americans would be on, these women who were there in the rural country, and they would probably make the choice to stay with the people,
right,
because that's whom they're serving. And, but again, a life of prayer separate from the people. Mm-hmm. They do serve in the clinic one day, but they live a life of prayer. And but would the people defend them? You know, the their neighbors really come to their aid. There's this cultural gap when you're living in another culture. And of course, the U.S. is about as complicated in Honduras as it is in French or in Algeria, I'm sure. I mean, so it's very interesting to see, to think about, you know, if there were to be military action or rebel action, which there is because of the drug culture, the drug cartels, that if you're an American, you're a target, no matter which side you're on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're not on a side. but you're very vulnerable. And they've been robbed a few times because these guys think that they have money because they're Americans. They don't have any money. They're very poor. They don't have any money. They have no cash to give. And it's been interesting to just see, to, there's our daughter living there completely at risk, but that's their choice, to give their life to their religious commitment.
Well, that does, but it raises kind of a difficult question about evangelism or Christianity. I mean, to go ye therefore into all the world. I mean, were these monks naive or idealist? I mean, or you know what?
Well, I think so. Often the monastic call is to the life of prayer, and the world comes to you in the life of prayer because you're praying for everything. Many monastics are not evangelistically oriented.
Right.
They're called to be in a community, in a place, set apart, and usually they serve their community.
Right.
Every order has a different rule that would guide how much they're engaged. But that don't. Mm-hmm. The, for me, the thing that really spoke to the tension in the movie: are we staying with the people? Or are we going to leave?
Right.
And when we're confronted, are we going to stay and die if that's what happens? Right. Is this really our home?
Mm-hmm.
Are you really my people? You monastics. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's very. Very alive kind of choices.
That's true. So there's a couple different really, you know, one is what are Christians called to do outside their own culture? The other is what are specifically monastic Christians called to do?
Right.
Two different things.
I'm curious if there, what other Christians in the culture in Algeria at this time, you know, we didn't encounter any secular Christians in the movie.
Well, I mean, one, I guess, question coming from that point that I think about, it comes up a little bit in the movie, is that to what extent can or should Christians engage in dialogue with Muslims? I mean, we have very little bit of dialogue here between the monk and the leader of this rebel group. But
what do you mean by that? Religious beliefs?
Well, related question. What purpose can be? What's the goal of engaging in dialogue? Is it just simply to understand and respect one another's religions, or can one achieve some kind of a common ground? And is that something we should strive for, or?
Or is that something that you will be arrested for because you're trying to, I mean, in some areas, you will be arrested because you will be seen as trying to banish the
law. Right, it depends how you define proselytize. I mean, if you're witnessing, if you're just kind of explaining what you think and feel, is that proselytizing, or is that just simply engaging in conversation?
Mm-hmm.
But is there grounds for commonality? And that's, I guess, with the handout, that's one thing I'm getting at is, I mean, I include the quote from the Quran that he has, you know, talking about Christians. Like I said, if you want to read it for yourself, there you can find the Quran. And the second...
Quran says Christian.
Sorry?
I'm surprised the Quran... Is the Quran a constantly... increasing. I mean, it's not like the Bible, which is set. The Quran.
No, it's set.
Yeah. Why are they talking about Christians in the Quran?
It comes after Christianity.
Oh, okay.
No, that's one little trivia point. I mean, actually, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is mentioned more times in the Quran than she is in the Bible. I mean, Muslims see themselves as sort of the third and final installment, as you will, of Abraham's, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so it just as Christians sort of include the Torah and the Hebrew scriptures in our own Bible, the Muslims sort of do one better, and they say, all right, we'll include both. Well, Old Testament and some of the ideas in the New Testament, I think, and there's a lot of the New Testament they would disagree with, but sort of the basic stories of the New Testament are incorporated into the Quran.
Yes.
So that I just put another line in there. I mean, as much as people emphasize in the caricature of Islam is that it's sort of hell-bent on warfare, but in fact there's a lot in the Quran that talks about peace and love and charity and so on. So I just put in one of the lines from there to demonstrate that. And then the third quote at the bottom is, the movie is based on a book that was written about this episode called The Monks of Tiberim by John Kaiser. And in his introduction, he explains his fascination with this event. And so I copied a couple of excerpts from that because I thought it was pretty interesting. And also speaks to, I think, why the filmmakers were interested in this episode. And on the back of the sheet is the letter that is quoted from extensively at the very end of the film. At this point, I don't know, maybe I think the letter itself has a lot of interesting points. Maybe we take a few minutes and just we can read aloud or maybe read it silently. Okay, yeah. Maybe someone want to read the first paragraph? And maybe I can get a copy. Is there an extra copy?
Oh, yeah, there's
something
in the tree. Oh, there's a bunch. I'll
read the first paragraph. If it should happen one day, and it could be today, that I become a victim of the terrorism which now seems ready to encompass all the foreigners living in Algeria, I would like my community, my church, my family to remember that my life was given to God and to this country. I ask them to accept that the one master of all life was not a stranger to this brutal departure. I ask them to pray for me, for how could I be found worthy of such an offering? I ask them to be able to associate such a death with the many other deaths that were just as violent, but forgotten through indifference and anonymity.
Someone else? Second paragraph? Let's read the whole letter. Yeah.
My life has no more value than any other, nor any less value. In any case, it has not the innocence of childhood. I have lived long enough to know that I share in the evil which seems, alas, to prevail in the world, even in that which would strike me blindly. I should like, when the time comes, to have a clear space which would allow me to beg forgiveness of God and of all my fellow human beings, and at the same time to forgive all, with all my heart, the one who would strike me down.
I can keep going?
Sure. Yeah,
I could not desire such a death. It seems to me important to state this. I do not see, in fact, how I could rejoice if this people I love were to be accused indiscriminately of my murder. It would be to pay too dearly for what will perhaps be called the grace of martyrdom, to owe it to an Algerian, whoever he may be, especially if he says he is acting in fidelity to what he believes to be Islam. I know the scorn with which Algerians as a whole can be regarded. I know also the caricature of Islam, which a certain kind of Islamism encourages. It is too easy to give oneself a good conscience by identifying this religious way with the fundamentalist ideologies of the extremists. For me, Algeria and Islam are something different. They are a body and a soul. I have proclaimed this often enough, I believe, in the sure knowledge of what I have received in Algeria in the respect of believing Muslims, finding there so often that true strand of the gospel I learned at my mother's knee, my very first church.
Someone else?
Okay. My death clearly will appear to justify those who hastily judge me naive or idealistic. Let him tell us now what he thinks of it. But these people must realize that my most avid curiosity will then be satisfied. This is what I shall be able to do, if God wills. Immerse my gaze in that of the Father, to contemplate with him his children of Islam, just as he sees them, all shining with the glory of Christ, the fruit of his passion, filled with the gift of the Spirit, whose secret joy will always be to establish communion and to refashion the likeness, delighting in the differences.
Yeah.
For this life given up, totally mine and totally theirs, I thank God who seems to have wished it entirely for the sake of that joy in everything and in spite of everything. In this thank you, which is said for everything in my life from now on, I certainly include you, friends of yesterday and today, and you, my friends of this place, along with my mother and father, my brothers and sisters and their families, a hundredfold granted as was promised.
Why don't you go ahead and finish it up?
And you also, the friend of my final moment, who would not be aware of what you were doing, yes, for you also I wish this thank you and this adieu, to commend you to the God whose face I see in yours. And may we find each other happy, good thieves in paradise, if it pleases God, the Father of us both. Amen. Hmm. Pretty powerful.
Yeah, yeah, knowing, sort of predicting his own martyrdom.
It sounds like he has some deep insights about, you know, true Islamism and what the Quran teaches, which is far from what we see in headlines. He saw the commonality, the connectedness, rather than the differences, and was lifting those up. You know, we always resolve the differences. Can't we just embrace differences?
There's the potential for harmony.
Yeah.
I've seen this movie twice now, and both times, after watching the movie, I come away having very positive feelings for Luke, who seemed like a very saintly person. And the older man who was involved in providing medical care. I really didn't see any evidence in the movie to show that the other men were really doing what I would consider to be the work of Christ. They were just sort of living their own lives, self-serving sort of lives. And I don't really consider it all that noble that they stayed there and died. As far as the people in that community, yes, the medical care, if they were to have lost that, if Luke had chosen to stay, I see that as very noble because he was doing good works. And apparently the older man in his younger days had also done good works. The rest of them, I didn't see that. And particularly with Christian, both times I saw the movie, I came away feeling like he was sort of a cold, rigid sort of a Catholic. I was raised Catholic, and so I have certain feelings toward cold, rigid Catholic leadership. And he epitomized that in that movie.
I think that's very good what he said. Very good. I'm, you know, thinking about it, you wonder, how much were they helping the people in the village? Yes, the medical was great, but
Well, there is the scene where he's filling in the form for the woman, and she clearly can't write, and he's saying, you need to put your son's address here, and he's putting it down, and you need a couple of photos. Do you have any photos? She says, no. He says, we'll take you into the village when we're going on Tuesday or whatever it is. So there are hints.
That was Christian.
Yeah. There are hints that perhaps they help the folks in the village in other ways, although it's clearly not a huge focus of the town.
Well, didn't the villagers turn around the phrase of, you know, no, you guys are the branch,
right,
and we are the...
The bird.
The, you know, with the idea that there was some, you know, dependence, that this is the way the world is, and if you're not on that hill doing what you do, then our... then, you know, our world dissolves, how interrelated it is. So
yeah,
how, so
yeah, I thought that was very interesting, too. Do you see other evidence of that? I mean, that the monastery wasn't just a group of French guys doing their own thing, but that they were regarded by the community as a pillar of the community, or as, a,
right,
as a, the spiritual heart of the community, even. I mean, that's what I thought was another evidence of maybe this
yeah
harmony between Christianity and Islam,
yeah,
is that they were seen first and foremost as holy men,
right,
and secondarily as French or as Christian.
It transcended theology.
Right.
It was, you know, your acts speak so loudly, I can't hear what your words are saying.
Mm.
So it seemed like, I don't know.
Yeah, in the actual monastery, they did do quite a bit. I mean, they had literacy classes, they employed quite a few people on the farm and doing other tasks around the monastery, and then did some of those other things that were, you know, kind of showed you little glimpses of. I think in the movie, they couldn't tell you, show you all what they were doing. They're just trying to give you a few little snapshots just to kind of give you a sense of what their role was.
So maybe they were self-supporting too.
Yeah, yeah, with the food and honey.
Maybe that was a weakness of the movie, that it didn't portray that more vividly for people
yeah
to get
right
that perception.
Right. What do you think, was there, I don't know, do you think my analysis or could work, that they were seen first and foremost as holy men and only secondarily as Christian or French?
Yes.
And that sort of, whether they're imams or monks, they were
so
seen as sort of the spiritual
right
heart of the
and
community.
And it takes time for that religion to develop. They've been there generations.
Right.
Is that what you said?
Yeah, I think it was sometime in the 19th century when it was founded.
I think this kind of movie represents, again, the ignorance of our system, how ignorant we are of things like the Quran and the historical knowledge of the people of North Africa.
Or raises the question of whether the, you know, whether religion, you know, gets corrupted by scripture. I don't know. I mean, like, you know, I wonder how many of the people in the village were, you know, literate in the Quran or knew the Quran intimately. I mean, their Islam was sort of a practiced, sort of lived Islam, I mean, with the bar mitzvah type ceremony and the way they kind of treat one another. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, how much of Islam.
Well,
how much of Islam is represented accurately by the Quran, and how much if you want to learn about Islam, you know, judge it by the deeds of Muslims rather than the Quran.
But they were chanting the Quran to the townspeople, as compared with the monks who were chanting to themselves.
And, oh, I see.
You know,
and
they were
God
chanting, and that's how you learn is by, you know, there's a cultural behavior of worship. It's not just something that, you know, it's really integrated in.
Well, and I was interested, there was the one scene when the monks were gathered for worship, and there were others.
There was a few in the back row.
Gathered with them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I was surprised the men were in praying, the Islamic men were in praying, and the women were out visiting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the right, the ceremony, right. They're meant to illustrate segregation of the sexes, which is pretty common.
I know, but, you know, what they were being reverent or anything.
Oh, right, yeah, the women were all gossiping.
Yeah.
And do their thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
To me, this kind of represents an old style missionary concept where we go there and do things for them rather than teach them.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the doctor could have been teaching
exactly
two people in the village to be doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
That would be what I would call a modern concept
for
teaching a man to fish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A little paternalistic. They were still very dependent on their knowledge, that's a good
thing. Yeah, of course, we didn't, weren't given enough information either. I mean, Algeria has its own medical schools and stuff, so it sounded like they needed the missionaries to teach them how to do all this stuff. Yeah. I was thinking again, I mean, kind of previewing tomorrow's session, and I'm still intrigued by this idea that they were seen as holy men, because it's a common sort of a phenomenon in the Maghreb and Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco to have these sort of Islamic, if you will, or Muslims, monasteries, and we're, you know, going back 1,000 years, where these holy men, and this happened again in medieval Europe too, you know, where they were respected not just for their piety, but also for their literacy, also for their knowledge of, you know, being able to, a knowledge of medicine, knowledge of the wider world. And so what often happened was the zawiyas, the kind of these schools slash monasteries in rural areas, then became community centers, kind of, that people would come there, and they'd become lodges, or people would come to, you know, send their children to go and learn about Islam, learn Arabic. So this is a common phenomenon, especially in the mountains, where they're far from the cities, far from the centers of sort of imperial power, who's really calling the shots, are these kind of learned men who are, you know, both, you know, respected for their wisdom and their knowledge of God and their knowledge of, you know, anything. So I'm just wondering to what extent that contributed to the sense that the villagers saw them as the branch. You know, that they don't have, maybe they didn't have a zawiya there, so they thought the monastery fulfilled the same function. Yeah.
One other comment. I read about 15 years ago or so that there were 30 wars going on at the time, and 28 of them had been started by Muslim extremists. But I think that's just a cycle thing. If we go back 30 years or 50 years, probably we'd find just as many started by Christian or other ethnic groups or something like that.
Yeah.
I think the Muslims, the reason they're so in the forefront now is they're just a little behind the rest of the world in starting wars.
It's just their turn now.
It's their turn.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of politics to talk about, what their objectives are. But, well, I was wondering with the letter here, we can get a theology here. Like, there's one phrase there, I don't know if people think of it as particularly radical. You know, again, getting to Islam, whether it contains areas of agreement with Christianity, you know, the third paragraph of the last line. You know, I have proclaimed this often enough, I believe, in the sure knowledge of what I have received in Algeria, in the respect of believing Muslims, finding there so often that true strand of the gospel I learned at my mother's knee, my very first church. I mean, so he seems to be saying that some devout Muslims seem to have some appreciation for or are in fact living or preaching the gospel. I don't know, what do you think about that?
I guess it depends on how you define the gospel.
Yeah, right, right.
It really, I think we're touching on, it really is an interesting way to think about what is evangelism, you know, in a broader sense beyond like what do just missionaries do. What is evangelism? Is it living within the community and respecting other faiths and finding where you really can serve? Because we may say what we think they should have been doing, but the fact that they were invited to that, you know, that event. And then what was it when the military came in and talked to them about protecting them? And they kind of referred to the fact that there were other people that were dependent on them, and tried to convince Christian because, well, what about the other people who are, you know, dependent on you too? It's not just you. So even the military saw them as a community that was wider than just the monastery. So it's very complex.
Well, and that's, yeah, the author of the book upon which the film is based, he makes that same point too. You know, he says, you know, they did not die because they were Christians, they died because they wouldn't leave their Muslim friends who depended on them and who lived in equal danger. You know, that they saw themselves by that time as members of the community, and it was just their neighbors and their friends who they didn't want to abandon.
So is gospel, you know, I'm a beloved child of God, and, you know, or is gospel, Jesus Christ is my sole pathway to salvation? You know, so this seems to not be a narrow interpretation. It's the broader, you know, I'm in this community of beloved children of God, and that's how we treat each other. We live in community, we care about each other, we're in relationship. We're loving God and loving our neighbor, and isn't that the gospel?
Right. So in your study of history, had you ever heard of any of these men or this episode?
No, I hadn't. You know, I mean, it's, well, you know, history for me doesn't really, it's pre-1950 or pre-1900.
So the world, or at least in the United States, it would seem these men haven't really been elevated to the same level of martyrdom as, say, someone as Archbishop Oscar Romero.
Right, right. No, I think you're right. I think probably because it makes it a little more complicated when Islam enters the equation. Yeah, no, there's all kinds of sort of, you can find other African martyrs, not Christians, you know, Europeans, but, you know, people who died for their faith in the Sudan and other places. But they don't get much press. I don't know, well, I don't think you thought about this. I thought it was interesting that while they were respected by both the government and the rebels and the people for their Christian charity, you know, the reason when they got targeted or the area, the part of their identity that was problematic was their Frenchness.
Right.
And I'm curious what you think about that, and whether, you know, everyone sort of, I think it seems like everyone seemed to respect them for the charity they were doing, but when they finally.
How
were,
French? You know, I mean, I guess. None of those people were born in Algiers.
They yeah, my sense, the little biographies were that were given, my sense is they were all from France. Mm-hmm. And moved to others.
Well, didn't the government want them to go so they it wouldn't be a world embarrassment when they were killed?
Yeah.
I mean,
right, the government
they didn't care all what happened, they just wanted them not to, they didn't want the world to see this.
Right, right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's what the government's concern was, that it. Because it would make it look like they're not in control of things, that the
and they were in the France.
Yeah, France would get mad at them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what do you? I mean, I think we already talked about this. Touching the, you know, what does it mean to evangelize? What are Christians called to do in other cultures? I mean, are they meant to just go and serve as good neighbors, or is there some element of witnessing, or should Christians just stay at home? I mean, were the French monks being, was there a certain amount of arrogance there in trying to be monks in somebody else's country? Or
well, as they said themselves, they had nowhere else to go, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that monastery had been there for a long time, so, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody spoke French, really.
Okay. They just wanted to serve the people. I didn't think there was arrogance.
Mm-hmm. They didn't, weren't lording over them as French over Arab or anything.
No, I
don't know. Although they did like some apparent wine that they got. Yeah, and that music was clearly.
I thought that was really ironic in light of their commitment to stay.
What's that?
That the Frenchness would become an issue in light of their commitment to stay in Algeria. I mean, I agree with them. I think there are huge questions about evangelism, but also about loyalty to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Mm.
And loyalty at what cost and to what length. And
mm-hmm.
They remain loyal,
right.
Even though they're under that charge.
Right. And you know, who is my neighbor? You know.
Exactly.
They attract trouble.
Yeah.
It's always
yeah.
Being neighbors.
Well, they got into a little bit of trouble with the neighbors by treating the rebel guy, right?
Yeah.
So they're trying to minister to all, as it says to do in the gospel, although it is. And so then they attract the wrath of some of their neighbors when it's rumored that they treated a rebel.
That's kind of in the gospel too, that's what happens.
Yeah.
You attract wrath when you treat everyone as a neighbor.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Well, I don't know. Maybe the other thing from his letter I thought was kind of striking. He's like, you know, don't feel sorry for me if I'm killed because I'll be that much closer. Or then I'll be with God and can see how does God see his children of Islam. I don't know, I thought that was... And he says, talks about God delighting in the differences. That's where it's at.
Yeah.
Well,
I think the thank you to his murderer in this letter is
yes.
In Bright Hameling session yesterday on mysticism of community, they're calling for uncommon civility.
Mm.
And it seems to be an illustration of that.
Right, right. But again, I guess I was struck by this kind of broader sense of, you know, who God belongs to, you know.
Okay.
That all, shining with the glory of Christ, the fruit of his passion, filled with the gift of the Spirit, whose secret joy will always be to establish communion and to refashion the likeness delighting in the differences. You know, that God so loved the world, not God so loved those people who, you know, self-identify
as Christian. We forget that God's not Christian.
Right. Well, last week my sessions were slightly different. One of the books I'd recommend from last week was a book by Desmond Tutu. I think it's still in the bookstore, but the first essay, which I think is the title to the book, is God is Not a Christian.
Yeah.
It's kind of provocative. His point, you know, being this, you know, that Christians, you know, want to remake God in their own image, as it were. Well, you know, he's running out of time. Are there any other thoughts? Well, then, happy good thieves. I like that too.
Wow. Yeah.
Tay, you will be with me. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.